All right, we're going to be talking today about Purim. Purim is a holiday. It was just this past Wednesday through Thursday. And a Jewish holiday is always run an evening to a morning. Because just like in Genesis, the days were evening and then a morning. And so, what is Purim and why should we care? We are a Christian church. So what do we care about all this Jewish stuff for? Well, it's important. I'm not saying you need to be a Jew. I'm not saying you need to be a wannabe Jew. But there is a lot that is not taught in the church. Just like in high school, there's a lot they don't teach you that your first year go, gosh, why didn't anybody tell me this? Why wasn't there a class for this? Well, in the same vein, there's a lot that is overlooked or just simply not taught because it hasn't been taught or it hasn't been modeled. And so that's why it's lacking in the church. And that is the Jewish perspective. The big wow, the big surprise is, hey folks, guess what? Christianity sprung from Judaism, from from the Jewish people. And that Jesus was Jewish. And the context of the New Testament is in a Jewish perspective. And while the Gospels are written with certain contexts towards the audience, for example, Mark being written towards the Gentiles, specifically the Romans, and Matthew towards more of the Jewish mindset, etc., we need to remember that the whole framework, the idioms, the mindset of the people who lived and wrote and witnessed the events in the Gospels in the New Testament times were Jewish. And that has a certain dimension to it, that has a meaning to it, that can help us understand things, and that can help us to avoid misinterpreting certain things. And there's a richness to it, that we have a heritage that is tied to the Jewish people, and that ultimately God used the Jewish people to bring who we believe is Messiah. And that means something. And just kind of to go off-road for a moment with the message, God didn't just use the Jewish people and say, hey, thanks for bringing Messiah in. Well, I'll just crumple you up and throw you in the waste bin of history. That's called replacement theology. That says, well, the Jewish people have no purpose anymore. They've been scraped aside and thrown out despite all the things that they had to bear and deal with being the people of God. What does that say about God? I will be your God, you will be my people, etc., etc. Oh wait, Jesus is here, never mind. That's what replacement theology says. It is anti-Semitic, it is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And that's not what we're about. That's part of what we're here to expose, is that anti-Semitic thinking that's in the church. It's also to show an appreciation for the people whom God said, you will be my people. It's not to worship. It's not to make Gentiles into second-class citizens like some messianic movements do. Oh, isn't it a shame that you can't be Jewish? It's a shame that God didn't see that you were fit to be one. But hey, you know, there's welfare, spiritual welfare available for you. Now, that's not what this is about either. But the Jewish perspective is to take that rich heritage, that diversity that is not an aberration, and celebrate it, that together we have a history. Now, again, what I'm not saying is that apart from Jesus you can have salvation. No. There is an uncompromising line written in his blood that says, you must believe. And yes, this will be a continual argument amongst Jewish people that no, we don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. You've got the wrong guy. Great idea, nice fella, not the person you're thinking he is. And that's where we will ultimately disagree. The other problem that typically comes in with Jewish relations is the fact that the church basically strips Jews of their Jewishness. It does it. And that's not right. God has called Jewish people to be Jewish. But he's also called them to receive Jesus as Messiah. How can these two things come together? I'm talking about a day when, in the church, there are Jewish believers beside Gentile believers, and the distinctions are almost trivial. I'm talking about a time when there are Jewish elders and pastors and evangelists and teachers and apostles and prophets, etc., who are working in concert with Gentile apostles and prophets and teachers and evangelists and working together and sharing in the community. And that the Gentile community does not withhold the Jewish community from celebrating those services and times that God said, and you'll do this throughout your generations. And the Gentile church supports that, should support that. And the Jewish side, community, part, contingent, whatever you want to call it, supports the Gentiles. And so that together, they are one community, one body, one bride, one functioning, healthy organism. That's what I'm talking about. And to go even farther, there's a vision that it's shared in Numbers that Balaam has. And he says, I see him, he's prophesying. He says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but he's far away. And he's seeing the Messiah, but he's trying to see something that is beyond his time. And it's like that with what I'm seeing with this. I can't even put it into words. But it has to start somewhere. And it doesn't exist yet. And nobody's talking about how to do that. And it's not coming through the preaching. And so this is how it begins. Anyway, we're talking about Purim. And why should we as Gentiles even care about such a thing? Well, it's a very significant holiday, if you think about it. Purim is a celebration of the Jewish people avoiding extermination many hundreds of years ago. Want to say around between 5 and 600 BC. Somehow the number 586 BC seems to come to mind. I might be a little off on that. But over 2,000 years ago, there was a plot to exterminate the Jewish people, 600 years before Jesus. Had that plan worked, we would not have a Savior. We would be lost. That's, in a nutshell, why you should care. You want to stop the tape now, so to speak, tape. If you want to stop the message now and go forth with that idea, that's why we need to think about Purim. That's why it should be something that we go, oh, it's Purim. Do you have to do all the things with it? No, you don't. That's the grace of being a Gentile, in that, yes, you've been grafted in, it's not a requirement. It's not law. The only law that we have is the law of the New Testament, which is to follow Jesus and love him with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. But it is important. It is significant. And there are principles and value we can gain from it. And we miss that. Why? When's the last time you heard your pastor, your minister say, hey, Purim's coming up this week. Let's remember the example of Esther. Let's remember the example of Mordecai. Let's remember the example that Haman shows us. Let's show the example of from Xerxes. I bet you can't. You can't send me a coffee. The point is, you don't hear this stuff. And we're poorer for it. Purim means lots. In other words, dice. Things that are cast with numbers. It was a game. And it symbolizes the trivial derision that Haman had of the Jewish people of, I'm going to pick a day to exterminate them. Let's throw lots. Let's throw dice. Let's throw sticks. Let's throw whatever they are and see what date comes up. And the date that was appointed was the result of those dice being thrown. In a way, one could even say Haman, in his pride and futility, thought, there is no God. Everything's random in life, chance and circumstance. And so this will be the day of their demise. Not realizing there is a God who sees, Bir Lahai Roi, a God who sees and hears and cares for you and for his people, whom he has made a promise to. And so that plan was foiled. And we should be thankful for that. Because it is the people whom God said, you will carry this burden. You will have to deal with offense. You will have to deal with persecution. Why? Because you are being under my name. And you are part of my plan to render up a deliverer and a savior, not just for yourselves, but for all men. Hearkening back to the promise to Abraham, that in you all nations shall be blessed. So, what happens during Purim is that the Book of Esther is read, and it's actually quite interesting. It's very interesting how Jewish synagogues put together these events. They read, and there is a lot of audience participation. When the name of Haman is brought up, the people hiss and make noise and drown out his name as a reminder of how vile and wicked this man was. And there's all sorts of interactions and noises and sharing. And it's actually very fun. It's very fun. It's also a time to give gifts in celebration and thanksgiving for the mercy of God. Oftentimes, gifts of cookies, very specific ones. They're triangular cookies filled with fruit. And all, well, now it's become such a thing that there are all sorts of gourmet variations of it. But basically, it's giving gifts of sweets and cookies to one another as a minimum, or small tokens of appreciation, nothing super extravagant. But one should do that as an evidence of that thankfulness. So we tried to give out at least a couple of dozen of Hamantaschen, which is the name of the three-sided cookie, to friends who appreciate it, and even friends who don't know anything about Purim. We don't do that because we're trying to be Jewish. We do this because we are grateful as an expression of thanksgiving, as a partnership saying, we're glad you're here. To the Jewish people. And as gratitude towards Jesus, we're glad you're here, because without you, we'd have nothing. That's what Purim's about. But there's some spiritual principles that we can take from the story of it. And just for background reference, stop the message, read the 9 chapters of Esther, Esther 1 to 9. Probably take you about 5 or 10 minutes. It's a great reading. Read it carefully, read it slowly. Take the time to read it. But I'm going to just touch over some of the principles that the Lord's put on my heart. One is that Purim is about salvation. Why should we care about Purim? Because it's about salvation. It is about salvation in its purest concept. It's about the salvation of the Jewish people. And by extension, it's about the gift of Jesus to us. Because without Jews, there is no Jesus. And without Jesus, there is no us. There is no hope, and there is no future. Purim is about salvation, and it's about acting on what God speaks. And if you think about it, salvation is exactly that. Salvation is acting on what God speaks. Acting on what God speaks is righteousness. Righteousness keeps us from sin. Now, is it as simple as that? No, we're innately sinful. So it's not just about doing good things all the time. But hopefully you're getting the point that salvation is about doing what God speaks. Believing is not enough. Doing is a result of believing. Now we see something interesting at the beginning of Esther. Queen Vashti, queen of the king of King Xerxes, who ran an empire from Kush all the way through India, had this huge party, 180 days long, unimaginable long time to celebrate. And at the culmination of that celebration, he says, you know, it described like the military leaders, and he was showing the splendor of his kingdom, and then it comes to the kind of the peak of the celebration. Let me top this. Let me show you something even more splendorous. Let me just show you how much stuff I have. And it comes down to, I'm going to get my queen. And he sends for Queen Vashti. He says, I'm going to bring out my wife, the most splendid of all my kingdom. Now, that's really says something about what the king thought about his wife, the queen. Now, it happened that the queen also had her own little celebration and banquet as part of this. And so she had all the noble women and women of great standing in her court celebrating as well the empire. But something happened. She refuses to come at the king's command. The king says, come, bring your crown. I want to show you off to all the men and the great men of the kingdom because you basically are my greatest period. And she says, no. Actually, it doesn't even say that she said anything. She just said she didn't even come. She didn't even give him the dignity of a response. She basically unfriended him. And in ignoring the king, she loses all that was rightfully hers. She despised what she had, at what he had asked, rather, which was for her to be seen as a demonstration of the blessing and bounty of the kingdom. And it's shocking. Here is a woman who is probably the most powerful woman in the ancient world at that time, having a measure of power that would be completely unimaginable to the everyday woman, surrounded by other great women. And when the king calls, she basically goes, no, I'm happy with what I've got. I don't need you. And therein lies a hint, a remez, towards what we can take from this. Because in ignoring this request, in failing to act on what the king has said, she loses everything that was rightfully hers. She doesn't just lose what was hers, it was hers to lose. We don't know what her fate was, but I would imagine it wasn't very pretty. Now Mordecai, later in Esther, warns her, Esther being his cousin, who he adopted and took care of, he warns her when she is in the same position. And he says kind of the converse, which is, whereas Vashti was asked and refused, Esther isn't saying anything yet and needs to. So we see this interesting contrast between Esther and Vashti. That when the king speaks, we need to answer, but there are some times that we need to speak when we haven't been asked. And Mordecai warns her and says, listen, don't think that because of your great position that you will be safe from the calamity that is to come. That is, this plan by Haman to destroy the Jewish people, her, Esther, being Jewish. He says, don't think that just because you're the queen, you're going to escape. He said, if you fail to speak and act in this time, God will raise up deliverance from somewhere else and you will lose everything. This is from the perspective of a guy who has seen a lot of stuff go down. This is from the perspective of a guy who lived in Israel and was carried off to Babylon, who was part of this diaspora. This is a guy who saw Israel as God's nation. Secure. Nothing ever's going to go wrong. Because, I mean, we're God's people, right? And yeah, some people are being troublesome and not always listening to God, but you know, people are people. And then the nation's destroyed and they're carried off. He sees his uncle, Abiel, killed, and his aunt, which are Esther's parents. And so he takes her and makes her his daughter, basically, adopts her, takes care of her. But he sees and experiences things that should have been secure, that thought they were secure, and disaster just happened upon them. He also saw the king, Xerxes, have a plot formed by his own staff because they were disgruntled, planning to assassinate him. He goes and says something about it and foils the plot. But again, we see somebody who rules a mighty empire whose very ability to live is threatened by an offense. How fragile that security of life is. This is a man who's seen all that. And so his warning to Esther is, don't think that. I've seen it. I've seen it a lot. You think you're safe, and you're not. Now, it sounds very paranoid, but it's very pragmatic. If we refuse the King of Kings, what can we expect? How will it go for us if we claim to be believers but refuse to follow his requests to be seen by others for his glory? It won't go well. And as I was alluding to, Purim is about security in following God. The only protection that Mordecai ever knew was in obeying what God said, even if it was perilous to do it. The nobles argued with him in the square when Haman, who was the chief of nobles, would walk through and they would all get up and, oh, your majesty, you know, your greatness, it's so good of you to come by and bow or get down on their knees or stand up or show like respect or fear or both. You know, they make a big deal. Stroke his ego. Mordecai, hey, how's it going? And after a while, it says, the nobles kind of picked up on this and be like, hey, what's going on? Haman walked in the room. What's your deal? And it came to pass that over these discussions, and you can imagine these were probably not pleasant discussions. Some may have been true inquiry. Why do you, you know, the other guys, they seem to do that. But hey, man, like, what are you doing? Some might have even tried to befriend him, to help him. Hey, Mordecai, listen. You know, you got to bow. You got to pay your respects. You got to pay your dues, man. What are you doing? And some like, who do you think you are? I have to do it. Who do you think you are that you don't have to do it? And ultimately, it was revealed because I'm a Jew. Because I follow what God says. Because I'm not going to worship false idols. And so, after a time, they hatch a plot and say, we're going to tell. We're going to tell on you. And they tell Haman, and he gets angry. And then this hatches the plot. So in obeying God, Mordecai has imperiled not only himself, but the entire Jewish people. But he has to, because that's following God. And listen, following God will cause peril. Following God will cause strife. Following God will create waves. Jesus even said so. He said, I did not come to bring peace on the earth, but a sword. I have come to set a father against son and daughter, and that the members of a man's household will be his enemies. Jesus isn't there to be some sort of social disruptor, but he is there to say, listen, when push comes to shove, you got to pick whose side you're on. I'm going to be here forever. They won't. And so when God speaks, you have to be prepared to give up a little bit of security, because ultimately what you're saying is, I know that the world cannot give me security. Only God can. That's what that says. Look, I mean, Mordecai even rewarded the king. He revealed this plot that saved the king's life, and nothing was done. Did Mordecai go, well, that's it, hell with this. I'm done thanking God. I'm done doing what's right just because that's the right thing to do. I'm done doing what God says, because what did it get me? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And that would have been an accurate statement. Nothing had been done for him. But that's not the point. As I've said many times before, that the Jewish perspective often is simply this, is that God said it, that's enough. I don't need a reason. I don't need a reward. I don't need an incentive. I just need to do it. Hence, salvation. I need to believe and act on what God has said and trust in Him. And so, even with all that, Mordecai could look back at this time in the story and say, I did all this for the king and now my life is being threatened? Like, where's the justice in that? But he didn't. He didn't do that at all. Jesus warns us about taking security in the world and trusting in worldly things for our hope and our comfort and our peace. In John 16:33, he tells us straight up, these things I have spoken to you that in me you may have peace. That is, in me, you will have security. In me, you will have comfort. In me, you will have security. He didn't say me and. He didn't say me or. He said, in me. In the world, you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. Folks, if your hope is in your paycheck, if your security is in your knowledge and education, if your peace is in the checkbook, bank account, stock market, power of the dollar, size of your home, how much work your wife's had done to her, whatever it is, you will have tribulation. You will not have peace. You cannot find comfort in that. Money is only as strong as the economy behind it. And if you watch stock markets, that'll drive you nuts. Because one day it's up and one day it's down. And one day it's here and one day it's there. Today a dollar buys this much and tomorrow a dollar doesn't. You can have $1 million in the bank and no debt. And due to the changing nature of international economies, you can be a pauper. Think I'm kidding? Get sick. And not have insurance. Get sick. And have a treatment that isn't covered. And watch where that $1 million goes. Changes your paradigm, doesn't it? We've all been raised with that American culture. Work hard. Get a good education. Go to college. That's the answer to everything. That's the answer. That's the rainbow, isn't it? If you're over the age of 35, you know what I'm talking about. Since kindergarten, it was drilled into your head. That there's a rainbow, and if you just work hard enough, everything's going to come to you. Your dreams will come true. Well, you know what? Then you get a little older, you graduate college, and you go, what the hell was that all about? And all of a sudden, the dream, you wake up. And you realize it's not quite that way. Your security has changed. But you know what doesn't change? Jesus. He's always there. He changes not. And that is why Jesus says your security, your peace is in me. If your peace isn't in him, you need to get a hold of him. And you need to let him be your peace. Because nothing else will give you peace. Jesus gives the example of a man storing up security to have a good life. Doing everything that the world requires for security, money, goods, shelter, and in a day he loses it all, and now what? He faces eternity to answer for his life, and he's in peril. This is from Luke 12, 16 to 21. Jesus says, and he told him this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He had a lot of stuff. He had a good life. He had what he wanted. We can take that to be us. Maybe you're not fabulously rich, but you like your life. Everything's kind of right where you want it. It's almost like in Fight Club, When the guy's talking about how he just finished his collection from IKEA and his whole house is perfectly aligned and now everything's getting thrown into turmoil. Maybe you have your life just perfectly arranged. It's not a dream come true, but it's all right. It's doable. Maybe you don't want to rock the boat. Maybe you've got some trouble. And it's like, yeah, but you know, if I try and dream big, this is a safe space. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. And he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will be able to store my surplus grain. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. And we may look at ourselves saying, you know, I'm putting a little bit away. Or I'm not going to worry about this. It'll all be all right. My life's going to be great. And then I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God. Is that us? How are we towards God? Are we stingy? Are we miserly? But when it comes to our agendas, our plans, we're rich. It's like that person that always comes asking for something. You're suddenly poor. Oh, I don't have any time. I don't have any money. Is that how we are with God? Because God's the one who owns a cattle on a thousand hill. God owns it all. And yet, God's question, who's going to get what you've prepared for yourself? Who's going to get that? What did that get you? Because when life is said and done, what's that? Well, I don't believe there's anything else. That's a great philosophy. Really, it's a great philosophy. It's easy. It requires no faith. When I die, I just wink out of existence and that's it. The end. That'd be a great fantasy story. Because then I have nothing to worry about. But you know what? Here's the hard reality. It's not the end. When you die, you wake up somewhere else. And there is no end there. And there's no escape. Let that sink in. There's no escape from when you die, what you wake up to. That's it. There is no end. Now that takes a lot more faith. And that's a lot more disturbing than the idea that you just simply stop. There's been medical accounts of people in near-death experiences that have experienced things that are inexplicable, having knowledge in their immediate surroundings that was impossible and corroborated by the people that were there. There's more to this life than just biological, biochemical reactions. And if that's true, imagine, what has all that you've strived for gotten you for being prepared for what's to come? 70 years, 80 years, 90 years? Maybe you'll be blessed with long genes, 100 years. But even after 100 years, we all still face the same place, the same fate. And then what lies ahead? What have we done to prepare for that? Because your money, you can't take it with you. That's a truth. You can't take it with you. So earning money isn't going to get you anything. Doing nice things for people, that's nice, but that doesn't get you anything. What have you done? What will you get? See, looking at it in the context and the lens of Purim and Mordecai's example, that question that Jesus asks takes a new dimension. And who will get what you've prepared for yourself? What has that basically done to prepare you for what is to come? Now, going back to Mordecai, he might say, I did it because that's what's right in the eyes of the Lord. and that's enough for me. That's not just good works. That's being right with God. And in Mordecai's mind, perhaps it was, and that's my security, is in the end, I know I'm right with God. God's okay with me on this, and that gives me peace. James warns us that even demons believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Think about that. Demons believe Jesus is the Messiah. If you could see and speak to demons, you said, do you believe Jesus is the Messiah? Yeah, absolutely. How could you not? What, are you kidding me? I have to deal with that painful light every day, that I'm aware of the fact that my fate has been sealed, that I'm in chains of darkness, and all I have is the few winnowing decades that remain before his return, and then I have to face an incomprehensible future that will never end. That's the view of a demon. Misery loves company. You know, you think demons just do what they do because they're miserable fallen creatures? Come on. This is a distraction for them, tormenting others. Misery loves company. If I can bring you along for the ride, at least I won't feel so bad for now. But James is very explicit. Even the demons believe that Jesus is Messiah and tremble. His point being, great that you believe, but you need to act on that belief. That's why I said from point number one, salvation is action with belief, acting on belief. Demons believe. Doesn't do them a darn bit of good. Jude 1:6, the angels who did not keep their positions of authority but abandoned their proper dwelling, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for judgment on the great day. It's like Queen Vashti. She had her proper domain to be the wife of the king, the consort, his other half. And when the king speaks, being another half, she'd be there. But she wasn't. She left her proper dwelling and lost everything. Not unlike these angels who lost their proper dwelling. Now let's think about that for a minute. What's the proper dwelling for an angel? An angelos. An angelos is a messenger. What's the proper dwelling place for a messenger? And as an agent of God, but to carry out what he speaks and says to do. Again, we come back to the principle. Salvation is doing what God has spoken as a result of our belief. And Esther, her proper dwelling is to do what God says. There's a plot against the Jewish people. I must speak. To not speak in the time when God says to speak is to abandon our dwelling as his servants. And finally, Purim is about saying thanks. Purim is a celebration of God's salvation and mercy to us. For Gentiles, it should be with profound gratitude for the deliverance of the Jewish people, without whom Jesus could not have come. Luke 17:15-19 says, one of them, when he saw he was healed, this is talking about the 10 lepers that Jesus healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. A Samaritan is somebody who is half-Jewish, is married to a Gentile, and is basically considered by the Jews at that time to be not Jewish because they had abandoned, they intermarried with other people, and most likely were following other religions. Jesus asked, were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner? And he said to him, rise and go. Your faith has made you well. Your faith, your action, because of belief, because you regarded God, has made you well. So Purim is an opportunity for us to say, thank you, God. Thank you for delivering the Jewish people who bring me, it sounds like a commercial, brought to you by the Jewish people, givers of Jesus. But to give thanks to God for that. If we're not thankful to God for the Jewish people being rescued, what does that say about our gratitude towards Jesus? It's like being given a wonderful gift, but being annoyed at the giver. Well, I like the gift, but I don't like the person. I would have rather been somebody else. Hey, you know what? I'll just take that gift back. Well, God's not a man. He doesn't do that. But it shows ingratitude. If we claim to be believers and we ignore the value of Purim and what it represents and the gift that it is to us, what does that say about our gratitude? And God forbid we despise the Jewish people to say, well, it's just a Jewish holiday. Who cares? Well, you know, Jesus cares. Jesus cares. And that should be enough for us. So, I pray that you take some time to read the story of Esther, to look at the examples and the contrast of Queen Vashti, who abandoned her domain, and Esther, who had to step up to speak to the king, whereas Vashti refused the king, and the difference of their ends, one to obscurity and possibly death, the other to rescue and salvation and life. We look at the example of Mordecai, who teaches us about security in God alone, which is an echo that agrees with Jesus' statement of, in me alone you will have peace, because in this world you will have trouble. And to get a sense of an anchor for our own peace and security. Despite all that Mordecai could have complained about, he was faithful. And finally, to have a joyful and thankful heart for what God brings into your life. I pray that you have a new appreciation for the holiday of Purim. God bless.